Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is a part of The Realignment's daily series covering the big themes that drove 2022. If you're enjoying the daily episodes and would like to support the work the team is putting in this month, go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link in the show notes where you could subscribe for a monthly, yearly, or lifetime membership. Today's episode is focused on the defense industrial base, especially after the war in Ukraine, how much of the West's defense stock is depleting, about the prospect of immediate replacement. During the Daily Ukraine series, Sagar and I spoke with Christian Brose, Anduril's chief strategy officer, about his book, The Kill Chain, Defending America in the Future of High-Tech Warfare. This episode's a bit of a follow-up. I spoke with Trey Stevens, Anduril's co-founder and partner at Founders Fund, about a mission document put out called Rebooting the Arsenal of Democracy, which is linked in the show notes, along with several other pieces we mention. I'm personally interested in the issue, as laid out by Trey and Anduril. How can the U.S. successfully deter aggression by China and Russia, along with other revanchist powers? They say technology is key, but moving to 2023, I'm looking forward to exploring the other aspects as well. With that said, huge thanks to Lincoln Network for supporting the show. Hope you all enjoy this episode, and I will see you all tomorrow. Trey Stevens, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me, Marshall.
The mission statement that I want to talk about today came out in June, but this is actually the best time of the year to have this conversation, not just because we're wrapping a big theme, but there's an interesting juxtaposition between the world we're experiencing today, post-war in Ukraine, and the bigger set of work that you and the folks at Anduril and Founders Fund have been interested in. I'd like to get your reaction to something that came out of the Ronald Reagan National Defense Forum over the weekend, which is we lack the capability of replenishing basic ammunition stocks over the next 2 years, just given the expenditures that are happening in the war in Ukraine. And you, at the same time, when you were writing for Anduril, are talking about how our systems aren't software integrated enough. Your Snapchat camera has more capability than, you know, your typical like DoD implementation would be. Like, you know, our nuclear weapons, like missile silos, have floppy disks. So can you talk about that gap between the digital and just the fact that we still haven't solved basic analog problems like replenishing arms stocks?
Sure. I mean, yeah, there's a lot there. On the gap, I think a lot of this just has to do with the way that we've thought about acquiring new technologies for the Defense Department since the end of the Cold War. During the Cold War, the most talented people in the categories that mattered the most to the DoD, things like propulsion systems and radio, radar systems, and, you know, you can kind of go down the line. All of these people worked with the DoD, or the vast majority of these people were working with the DoD. Their research was being funded by the DoD. They were building capabilities for the DoD. Once the Cold War ended, for lots of really good reasons, they kind of dispersed into other areas. With the rise of software and the internet and things like that, people flooded into private industry, into things that, you know, impact us in meaningful ways today across our both consumer as well as our professional life lives. And the things that matter the most to the war in the future, which we can get into great detail about, you know, what happened in Armenia, Azerbaijan, what's happening today in Ukraine. These things are, you know, autonomy, applied artificial intelligence, sensor fusion, electronic warfare, cyber war. All of these capabilities are software capabilities at their core. But the people that we need to build these capabilities are optimizing ads right now, like Google and Facebook and things like that. They're not focused on, broadly speaking, they're not focused on these super strategic national security problems that that we really need to focus on for the future. And so we have this kind of divide where we acquired a bunch of weapon systems during the Cold War from, you know, the 50s through the 80s. And those systems, those platforms stayed in service after the Cold War. And we weren't acquiring at the same pace that we were acquiring before. The War on Terror presented like a kind of a very different mission set than we were used to, you know, than we were used to dealing with during the Cold War. And so we never really had any impetus to push us into thinking about great power conflict or competition again. And it's only just now kind of happening. And there's a lot of very different decisions that we'll have to make to remain competitive and sustain a deterrent advantage against our adversaries.
I'd love to get your technological reaction to the war in Ukraine, just in the sense that as of right now, it feels very 1980s. Put aside like the Bayraktar, you know, like drones and everything, you're talking about how HIMARS, right? This like incredible long-range artillery system, that's also 1980s, like vintage tech. So where are you seeing the kind of like, just what's your reaction to that? Like the way things have gone in the past year?
Yeah, I mean, we have previews of a bunch of this stuff in Syria with electronic warfare, in Armenia, Azerbaijan with drone conflict. As you mentioned, the Bayraktar TB2, which is a very effective military platform that's been utilized in Ukraine, was also being utilized by the Azerbaijanis against the Armenians very effectively in much more recent history. So really, like, Ukraine is kind of a pressure cooker for all of these technologies that are going to matter a lot moving forward. And, you know, you have Iranian Shahed drones, you know, all sorts of things like operating in an airspace. The Ukrainians are leveraging things like DJI Mavic 3s in ways that maybe no one ever expected that they would be used. And they're also leveraging all of this, as you say, 1980s era technology with HIMARS and Stingers and Javelins and things like that to get control over their airspace. And, you know, a lot of these capabilities are expensive. They have really challenging supply chain to replenish. I think at the Reagan Forum over this weekend, I don't remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of like a decade's worth of production of Stingers and Javelins had been used in the first 9 months of the conflict. You know, we've got a lot of questions to answer about how we're going to leverage existing capabilities that are really good at the exquisite use case that they're intended to be good with counter air systems, counter armor systems, things like that. And then also figure out how to leverage these next generation, very commercially led technologies to reduce the cost of engaging with a great power adversary that's throwing all sorts of stuff into your battle space. So it's a really, really interesting kind of learning experience, I think, for not only the Ukrainians who are dealing with it every day and trying to iterate as fast as possible, but also all of the countries, the allies and partners that are supporting them in that conflict as they need those critical resupplies.
Yeah, this is the part of the conversation where I want to kind of focus on like the words you choose to use and almost kind of definition. So in War on the Rocks, you kind of had an excerpt of the broader Rebooting the Arsenal of Democracy piece, and you kind of defined the central issue as the world's leading democracies do not have the technology to deter revisionist powers. I'd love to hear what you think about the word deterrence. Like, what does it's a word that didn't really mean as much in the context of the War on Terror. So people thinking about this term means more in a great power context. Like, talk to us about deterrence, like what that means to you.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I'll use like a kind of an interesting example. So in going back in American history, the Department of Defense was not always called the Department of Defense. It was actually called the Department of War. and that's the history of that. And the reality is like, I don't think there's anyone that wants war to happen. Like, you don't have like these, you know, four-star generals sitting in the DOD being like, oh, I could really increase my budget if there was just some active conflict happening somewhere in the world. I mean, nobody wants this. Nobody wants war to happen, which is why kind of the semantic change into calling it the Department of Defense was such a signal to the world of what we were trying to do. This is not about aggression. It's not about territorial acquisition. This is about defending our nation, our national interests, and doing that in a way that reduces to the fullest extent possible the loss of life, collateral damage that results from violent conflict. Deterrence is a key component to this. So, you know, we've both already referenced the Reagan National Defense Forum. Ronald Reagan is very famous for using this phrase, peace through strength. And that's really what deterrence is. If you boil it down to three words, those three words are peace through strength. How do you prevent your adversary from doing something that instigates conflict by providing a level of capability that makes it unthinkable that they should ever engage? This can be done in a bunch of different ways. It can be done with a technological advantage. It can be done with an economic advantage. It can be done with a geopolitical, like diplomatic advantage. There's all sorts of things that you can do. But the key kind of focus of the Department of Defense, and Secretary Austin has talked about this at great length, is integrated deterrence. How can we use all of the tools of state to make it unthinkable that our adversaries will do something that acts against our own vital national security interests, as well as those of our allies and partners abroad?
You know, when you were giving that example of no one wanting war, I agree with you, but I think a lot of listeners, especially given the ways that we kind of colloquially talk about war, that's going to seem kind of confusing. So I'd love for you to just kind of explain what's going through the minds of people, both at the Defense Department and within industry, because think back to what your listeners thinking of, President Eisenhower giving the military industrial complex speech, like the idea of like, wait, why wouldn't there be kind of like a perverse incentive towards, okay, there's now been 10 years of expenditure of munitions. That means we make more money. Like, explain kind of how that actually works, given the fact that you know people in the room, like you've been in the room, how that environment actually looks separate from our image as kind of like civilians.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference in being prepared for the worst and instigating the worst. I don't think those things are nearly as connected as people think that they are. You want to have the capability to deter a tremendous amount of conflict, but you don't necessarily want that to be brought to bear by your own choices, by your own actions. I guess there's like a bunch of different lenses that you could look at that. You could look at it as like, well, how does that explain Iraq and Afghanistan? How does that explain, you know, the Korean War, the Vietnam War? I mean, we could probably dig into the history of each of those things and the decision making that went into it, and how Congress was involved, and how the White House was involved, and how the DOD was involved. I can say with total certainty that there is no one in the defense industry that's like sitting around thinking about how they can get war to start so that they can profit from it. That's just, it just doesn't happen. Like, people care a lot about deterring conflict, setting up the world, at least to the extent possible, in a way that prevents loss of life. And, you know, we're all building towards that as a core advantage. And this is something that goes back to Augustinian philosophy, thousands of years ago, this idea of just war theory. So, you know, if you're going to engage in conflict, there are kind of rules. There are like kind of political theology rules for how you would engage with this. You want to do it in a way that's discriminate, so that it doesn't take life unnecessarily, and it targets very specifically. That's precision. So when you are delivering lethality, are you doing it in a way that is targeted to the right effects, towards the right military targets? It goes to just cause. Do you have the data and the evidence that's required to make a just decision about whether or not it's appropriate to engage in conflict? There's proportionality. If you are attacked in a certain way, are you responding to that attack in a disproportionate fashion that takes a greater toll on your adversary? So anyway, there's like all sorts of ways to think about this. I think actually everyone in the industry is like pretty aligned on just war theory. We're all pretty aligned on the concepts of deterrence. And, you know, despite what the media often likes to pretend is the reality, that there's, you know, people in back rooms rubbing their hands together thinking about dollar bills when people talk about war, I just don't think that that's actually the case.
I think you answered that perfectly, because when you're illustrating how complicated all those wars you just listed, the key point here is that of those complicated reasons, a dude sitting in Arlington with dollar bills is probably like one of the least likely to actually explain it. Last, for example, Desert Storm. Why don't we go into Iraq and overthrow Saddam then versus in 2003? If this was all about like, quote unquote, making money and spending money on, you know, new systems, you would think that those situations would be the same. I think what actually tends to matter more, why I focused on your point of deterrence or ideas, how people respond to complicated systems. And I think it's just really key to call and illustrate that. So Netflix actually talk about the defense industrial base itself. You said something really interesting in a episode of the Solar Punk podcast with Lucas Bagno, who has appeared on the podcast before. You referenced how we are still dealing with the aftermath of like a Robert McNamara Defense Department. Robert McNamara is JFK and then LBJ, Secretary of Defense. He's famously this World War II industry guy coming from Ford. He brought in the Whiz Kids. They really brought in all these like new systems and new ideas. Talk about how we're living with that legacy. And I think the second part of the question would really be, if Robert McNamara and this post-early Cold War generation are coming from the auto industry, like that centerpiece of like the first half of the 20th century, where do you think the next generation of like leaders in industry should be coming from? Because I don't think anyone's going to Ford today to get like the tippy tip top of, you know, the top of their classes at Harvard Business School.
Yeah, well, I mean, where McNamara comes from is actually kind of an interesting analysis of how things are working today. When McNamara joined as Secretary of Defense, the U.S. government had the ability to go to the largest American corporations and say, like, hey, Ford, what we really need is for you to build a tank or something like that. And by and large, American companies were aligned to do work with the government to help us deter conflict. That was like kind of part of how it all worked. I don't think this is necessarily the case today at all. Like, American companies, in quotes, are not necessarily, ready and willing to drop whatever their commercial business is to go and help the U.S. DoD with the things that are most critical and strategic. But I guess going back to the McNamara point, when he became SecDef, he looked around and he said, "Wow, the costs are kind of ballooning out of control. We have the ability probably to spend like the entirety of the government's budget on defense priorities. If we really wanted to, we could iterate very, very quickly through hundreds of new capabilities." But he basically believed that the tech edge was there. Like, we had the things that we needed to win if we were to get into open conflict with the Soviet Union. But what really mattered was quantity. We needed to have overwhelming force. And in order to have overwhelming force while preventing ballooning budget excess, the critical thing is to plan and to have cost controls in the system. And so the kind of the modern DoD procurement mechanism was built in order to build these like planning exercises, these budgeting exercises, to make sure that we were getting the quantities of things that we needed at the best possible prices from the vendors that we're buying them from. And this worked for a very, very long time. You know, he took like cost plus contracting from over 37%, ratcheted it way down to, the teens. And that kind of like maintained through the Cold War, even after we won, into the Clinton administration, kind of bringing the defense, like kind of leveling the budget out and bringing it back down as a lesser percentage of US GDP. But as our adversaries started becoming more technologically competitive, we haven't shifted. And so we're kind of largely stuck in this era of quantity over quality, of planning and budgeting over advancement. And we're in some cases falling behind. In other ways, our adversaries are just becoming much more competitive. We're not iterating fast enough. It takes far too long to like get something through the process and into the field. And our adversaries are moving significantly faster. Like in many cases, China's moving over twice as fast in going from early research and prototyping into fielding than we are. I think this is where you're starting to get a lot of this kind of boiling concern from the industry about doing something to change the way that the procurement process is handled, so that we can get more advanced capabilities to field faster.
I want to discuss this then very literally, kind of comparing your example of today. So let's think about this in 1960s terms. So if you're Robert McNamara, you're thinking to yourself, okay, there's this MiG-25 Fox bat. It's a interceptor. We're going to produce the F-15. The F-15 is superior to the MiG-25. We're going to produce more of them, and we're going to keep the cost down. Like, that's basically the objective. You do that, you win the Cold War. Using the technologies you've referenced earlier, so the electronic warfare, drones, alternate systems, like, what would you say would be the articulation we're striving to do today? Is it less that does more at a cheaper price? Like, how would you say the formula would exist in today's context?
Yeah, there's this false dichotomy that exists in Congress in particular, where you have some people that are saying, like, we need to do more with more. We need more budgets. We have more capabilities, more unit quantity of the things that we're buying. On the other hand, you have like the less with less crowd. Like, we should have less of a focus, less capability, whatever. And we should also spend a lot less in getting there. But as you know, Marshall, like, the definition of technology is literally doing more with less. I believe that it would be possible to save the taxpayer hundreds of billions of dollars and give the warfighter better capability than they have today. But to do that, we have to lean more heavily into leveraging commercial off-the-shelf technologies. We need to move away from cost-plus contracting. There's all sorts of things that we could do on a tactical level to make that work. But it will require heroic leadership. Just like, you know, FDR pushing the original arsenal of democracy in 1940 before the U.S. entered the war as a support mechanism for our allies. And just in the same way that, we've had these heroic moments throughout history that have forced paradigm shifts. This is, I think, one of those that we're going to have to get right in the coming years.
That's really interesting. I'm glad you focused on technology. Can you help kind of the non-technical listeners? When you're talking about, you know, and your pieces like reference, like Mark Andreessen, great previous guest for folks who haven't listened to the episode from back in June, you reference Mark Andreessen's Software is Eating the World article from, 2010 that came out in the Wall Street Journal. What is the difference between like a jet propulsion, right? Like innovating jet propulsion during World War II and trying to make, let's say, the DoD not have floppy disks in the, nuclear weapons program. Is there like a conceptual difference? Like, as someone who comes from the tech industry, do you think of these challenges as, I'm not saying one is easier than the other, but is there kind of a same inputs and outputs process, or are they different?
Yeah. There's probably a few different cuts on this. So on the like hardware jet propulsion side of things, first off, I don't think there has been a lot of innovation in this space over the last 70 years since 1950. I mean, we've made incremental progress. We're making the engines more efficient. Over the course of the first 25 years of the Cold War, we did a lot to increase speed up until we built the SR-71, and then we really kind of just stopped there and haven't really done a whole lot since. There's obviously work that's going on in ramjets. There's work that's going on in hypersonics today that there's some really interesting companies working in. But then you could also look at like solid rocket motors and what's happened there. And has there really been any like massive chemistry advancements that have made that markedly different? And there probably are. There's things that we can do. But to McNamara's point, largely like the tech advantage existed. We built the things that our adversaries were not able to build. They were not going to compete on SR-71 technology. And I think you'd even be hard pressed today to say that our adversaries are going to like catch up to where SpaceX is in, orbital launch. Like, we have these massive tech advantages on some of these really complicated hardware systems. Software has tracked very differently. And I think to my earlier point, a lot of that just has to do with the people that we need to build these software capabilities. They don't exist in large enough quantities in the government sector. Like they're doing other things. Figuring out how we can get these people to come back in focused on these areas of national significance is like going to be one of the great challenges of our day. At least I think it will be. The nuclear floppy disk thing, I'm not sure that's exactly the right analog, because there's some advantage, for what it's worth, to our nuclear arsenal being connected to floppy disks. It's certainly much harder to hack if it's completely analog. But also, like, you know, we're going to do very, I would guess, we're going to do very rare, very occasional updates to the nuclear triad. It's like, it's super expensive. These things are sitting in bunkers. Like, it would be kind of crazy for us to do, like, you know, the speed of software development updates to the nuclear triad. It would also be incredibly expensive. I'm not sure that's the right thing to focus on, but it is kind of silly that they haven't been touched since, you know, before the Cold War. There's probably some frequency of update that we should have an expectation of that would be a little faster turn than that.
I'm smiling here because that is probably the first and ever defense of the floppy drive status quo you're ever going to hear in any tech context ever. But I think it's the right one to that point. Okay, so here's another question that I'd love to hear your thoughts on, especially given that you are an operator, you're a co-founder of Anduril, but also you're a venture capitalist, and you obviously are working closely with government. We've had Catherine Boyle on the show before. We've talked about this question. When you're pointing out how the U.S. can't just say, hey, dude who's crushing it in Web3, or, you know, person who works on ads at Facebook, it's time for you to go work on an area of not, we can't do that under our system. And that's a good thing. In China, by contrast, there's civil military fusion, a concept you've referred to, but also at the end of the day, like, this explains why Xi Jinping declared war on the tech industry. Like, it was, they determined at a literal level, this isn't a productive area of engagement in our economy, so we're going to redirect energy out there, even if that means Jack Ma gets locked up for a while. So how do you think a Western liberal democracy, and I'm asking this to you as a VC and as a company founder, how do you think Western democracies handle this question without having to wait for quote unquote, like, the Sputnik moment? Something you mentioned, usually is kind of like not a good thing. Like, you don't want a invasion of Taiwan. Then we're like, oh, hey, now we're going to have everyone switch to the necessary area because we see how important it is. You want to have it happen before there's an actual crisis.
Right. Yeah. And I think to your point, like, civil military fusion in China, a lot of the way these exact same kind of economies work in Russia, Iran, I'm assuming North Korea and things like that. It's like there are advantages to that system. And I think this is the type of thing that we always get very anxious talking about in the West, to say that, like, there's an advantage of an authoritarian system, but there are advantages. And I think they're reaping the benefits oftentimes of those advantages. That said, I would not trade for those advantages. I think the freedoms that we have in Western democracies to decide that, you know, we have control over what we want to do and what we don't want to do, is, you know, kind of one of the most important characteristics of why we appreciate the freedoms that we have. And so the reason I say that is that when, you know, Google pulls out of Project Maven or whatever, like, man, that's, as much as that, like, bothers me at, like, a personal emotional level, like, that's actually kind of awesome. Like, I want that to continue being the case. Like, I would love for American companies to have the optionality to say, no, I don't want to do that. That's not what my business is. That's not what people signed up to work on when they joined my company. We're not going to do that. I think that's great. It's an awesome part of what makes America, America. And that is a freedom that I would fight for. That said, to your point, like, how do we get these people to come back? I think that there's a bunch of different tactical things that you could do. And I can throw out a couple of ideas here.
Yeah.
But I think part of it is, we need to see winners. This is, like, the probably the most important one is that, you know, I don't want to be too harsh on Web3. I think you know, the jury is still out. It's still very early, obviously. But, like, you know, part of what made that so interesting to so many people is that money flowed. Like, there was a lot of money to be made. People saw that there were success stories. People saw that there were winners. And people are going to, you know, they're going to chase it kind of Jerry Maguire style, like, show me the money. If I think that there's some hit here, I'm going to be running after it full speed. Obviously, there's, like, you know, the decentralization libertarians or whatever at the early part, like, maybe they were less motivated by that. It was more ideological, but there aren't that many super ideological decentralization libertarians. I think there were a lot of people that were just showing up slightly later to the party because they thought that's where the future was going. And so I think one of the things that's really important for all of these critical industries, not just like explicit defense stuff like what Anduril's working on, but also things like reshoring industrials for the United States. Like, what are we going to do about semiconductor manufacturing? What are we going to do about new methods of propulsion? What are we doing about power systems? What are we doing about lithography? I mean, there's like all of these things. I think we need success stories. And if we have big winners where the needle is moved and money starts to flow, I think it will be way more compelling and interesting for people to dive into that and focus on those problems, because then they can unify that like kind of raw, somewhat selfish interest with it, a connection to a mission that they believe in. I don't think that the vast majority of the most talented people are opposed to working with the DoD. I think probably the vast majority of the right people don't believe that there's a job for them that they would want with the DoD. Like, you know, nobody wants to sit in a concrete basement in the middle of the country working for Northrop Grumman. That's like it's a pretty not fun job. So that's the first thing. The second is like
a quick pause before we get into the second. Yeah. I have a follow up there. What is the ceiling on winners? Because to your point on previous podcasts you've been on, the winners, quote unquote, of like, let's say this post 2000 space are Palantir, SpaceX, obviously, and then like Anduril being the youngest of those three. So when you define winners, do you mean that there need to be plenty of like high paying engineer slots at those three companies? Or do you mean there's a world where there's actually 7 to 10 to 15 other unicorn level defense-centric startups that could exist out there that would create incentives for founders, engineers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? How do you think about the term winner?
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that I think there needs to be a $1 trillion defense company. Like, that's definitely not what I'm saying. You know, the big five primes, I think, are all somewhere in the like $80 to $120 billion market cap.
So like Boeing, those companies?
Yeah. Boeing, Northrop, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, whatever. Like they're big companies. They also are operating on very, very low growth and very thin margins. I think if we shifted the way that procurement was happening more into a fixed price model that had higher margins, that had much higher spend on research and development, that had higher growth, you know, there's room for dozens of really interesting companies to be started that could force a paradigm shift in the way that that we're engaging with conflict internationally and current conflict.
What does the fixed price thing mean? Like, what's the significance?
Yeah. So a huge percentage of the DoD budget is spent on what's called cost plus contracting. And that's where the contractor is reimbursed for all their costs plus some fixed margin, usually like 7 to 12%. When the government is a buyer, they're basically saying like, I'm going to give you a little bit of overhead, essentially, and that will be your profit. Now, the challenge with that is that the incentive structure is pretty messed up, because if you can get something done with $10 million and get 7% margin, well, you just made $700,000. But if you can drag that same exact thing out to be $100 million, well, you just made $7 million. And so you can actually increase your profits by being less efficient. and that's not great for the taxpayer. Fixed price would be to say, I'm going to deliver a completed thing to you at this price. And now if it takes me a lot more effort, a lot more labor, a lot more, you know, bill of materials to deliver that, well, that's going to cut into my profit. So I need to be as efficient as possible to increase my own profits. And so I think we need to get that. By the way, that's literally the way every market works. That's what we just need to push a more commercial approach to the way that business is happening to the extent possible. And there will be things that doesn't necessarily make sense for, like, you know, the B-21 and aircraft carriers and stuff like that. Like, much harder to imagine a commercial approach to a product like that. But there's, you know, a lot of things that it would make a lot more sense to do that way.
Oh, so I know you're going to get to your second, but I want to keep following here. Because the key thing is, like, Anduril is not like an aircraft. you've not found the pitch for a cheaper aircraft carrier here. Like, what technologies are, let's say, primed for more of like a Silicon Valley, like, technology focused, like, innovation?
Yeah. I mean, the benefit to the taxpayer in the way that this like more commercial approach happens is that the government is not owning singularly the cost for the development of these products. At Anduril, we are privately financing the development of the products that we're building, and then we are selling them to the government at a price that at which we can get enough margin that we can turn that back into the research and development engine of the company to keep pumping out more and more products. That the taxpayer isn't paying for the at-risk research and development for. And that's good. That's good for America. And this is, you know, there's a lot of different things that could fit this category. Largely speaking, like Anduril's products that we're selling, whether it's surveillance systems, unmanned systems like drones, underwater vehicles, ground vehicles, space-based systems, you know, a bunch of that, these things. They're built with a lot of commercial hardware. And so we'll buy the best-in-class technology, whether it's sensors or compute or, you know, whatever it might be, and we'll build a defense-specific capability around that. And then drop in our software backend, which we call Lattice, which is kind of the autonomy system that drives all of our products. And, you know, we can do that as a result of that leveraging commercial technology. We can do that a lot faster. We can do it much cheaper. We can leverage the kind of the amortized cost of those products over all of commercial industry, all the people that are using it. I think a huge percentage, the majority of what the DoD buys can be bought in that way. You know, whether it's like, you know, ground vehicles that are leveraging the same thing as commercial ground vehicles, drones that are leveraging a lot of the parts that are being used in commercial aviation. You know, the list goes on and on, but probably not worth getting into more detail than that.
It's been a while, so this is my bad as an interviewer. Do you remember what your second point you were getting into was?
Yeah. I also was saying, like, reiterating the civic importance of engagement is also really important. This is something that probably one of the more controversial points that I believe to be true that most of my peers would disagree with me on is I think it would be awesome for us to have mandatory civil service after high school. I think it would be a really, really awesome experience for almost everyone. I don't think necessarily it needs to be like going and, you know, doing basic training and being a soldier. Like, the federal government is huge. Most of it is civilian. I think it would just be really good for people to have exposure to how our government works. Because the people that I know that have had some sort of civic government exposure leave feeling a responsibility for contributing in a way that is advancing the cause of the nation, and also understanding that not everything is politically tribal. And I think this is like one of the most interesting things that happens, certainly for like Anduril employees, people that come in, that these areas tend to get reported on as if they're these super political things. And every time the administration changes, all of the policy changes. It's just kind of ridiculous. Like, actually, the defense bill is the most bipartisan annual appropriations bill that happens every year. There are Democrats and Republicans alike both believe national security is important. Soldiers are not on the front lines thinking like, I really must execute the policies of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. This is bipartisan. And I think huge chunks of what the federal, state, local governments are responsible for are just making society work in the most streamlined way as possible. And, you know, a lot of that is not super partisan. I think, increasing communication about this in the tech sector. GovTech as an industry has become more popular over the last few years. My friend Jem Palka, who is the founder of Code for America, wrote a book that is, I think it comes out May of next year, about coding for America, like how we can leverage talent in the technology industry to make a positive impact on the way that civic governance works. There are so many opportunities. It'd be super cool if more people were exposed to this and felt a sense of responsibility, not only for criticizing the government and being a complainer when things happen that they don't like, but having a positive impact by being personally engaged in doing things that they believe are important for the country.
So as listeners in the tech industry, we're no doubt now we're going through a bit of a downturn period that some people compare to the dot-com bust in a couple of different ways. The dot-com bust obviously changed Silicon Valley, that real step change from the 1990s to the 2000s period that led to Google IPOing and Facebook and that old Web 2.0 era. I'm curious, are you seeing it all as someone who's deeply engaged in the very literal real world part of tech, like any kind of almost vibes different from like engineers outside of industry interest? You know, folks are no doubt going to know about the Mark Andreessen It's Time to Build essay. Is that energy kind of going there as people know they won't be able to get a big job at Meta the same way? How do you think about this dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like, there's some intersection there for sure. Like, you know, as the macro conditions have shifted against a lot of highly speculative, you know, tech optimism. The government is a recession resilient space. These are not spaces where there's going to be a bunch of headcount reduction. Business as usual. Things are moving for sure. So I think that will be some of it. I think there's also just like a highly emotional component to this. And I don't even want to suggest one way or the other that it was right or wrong, but you know, one of the things that our founder at Andrew Palmer Luckey mentioned in an interview on Friday is that you can't reason people out of something they didn't reason themselves into. I think a lot of times people are just like, well, I don't want to work with the government because I don't like the president. It's like, well, the government is much bigger than the guy in the White House. And I think that given the political persuasion of the majority of Silicon Valley, I think having a Democrat in the White House makes it much more palatable to work on things that are related to governance, whether or not the politics of the White House have any bearing whatsoever on the thing that they are interested in working on. And so I think there's like that deeply emotional component that just plays into this as well. It's like, people just don't want to feel like they're working for someone they perceive as their enemy.
So for this last section, I want to focus on the principles that were written out at the end of the report, give people some good takeaways for the end of the year. So the first principle is, and this is from like y'all's perspective, like what makes the most sense, like outpacing the threat. So the example given is, it takes, you know, 16 years in the United States to deliver a system at optimal capacity compared to 7 years in China. And obviously, if you're looking at like, you know, insurgent, guerrilla, like non-traditional, irregular groups, it's much quicker than that. Probably like what we're seeing in the Donbass right now is not that 7 year, not that 60 year period. So talk about this principle and why it matters beyond the obvious.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the fun stories from the early days of PayPal is that their ability to survive as a company was just related to how quickly they could iterate their security model to avoid fraud that was happening on the system. And so a bunch of things that have become very commonplace for us, like, you know, authentication and CAPTCHAs and stuff like that, it came out of this highly iterative process that was being developed at PayPal and during the PayPal days by other vendors as well. And I think that's roughly what is happening in Ukraine, except with Battlefield capabilities. And so, you know, they're like making modifications to missile systems to put them on MiG-29s. And these are things that like, if you had built a program around doing this in the United States, it would have taken a decade to like validate, authorize, make the modifications, do a block upgrade, blah, 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 blah. It would have taken a very long time. Ukraine did it in like literally months. They were just like, well, we need to make this work. We're going to accept the risk of test and evaluation on this, and we're just going to get it done. We're just going to roll it into the theater and see what happens. And I think that this is just like, it's just like the PayPal experience. It's like all they're doing is receive input, provide output, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, to try to stay ahead of their adversary. And doing that at a grand scale is where deterrence happens. If we are iterating more quickly than our adversary, if we're building capabilities that make it unthinkable for them to engage in conflict, And then we are consistently iterating to try to stay that far ahead. I believe we have the ability to massively reduce the loss of life as a result of political conflict. And this is the name of the game. We have to do a really good job at this to win.
Second one is building to mission, not to spec. Like, what do those words mean?
Yeah. So, mission would be, what is the problem that we're seeing in the field? So if the DoD comes to us and says, we're having this very specific problem, there are two ways that they could solve that problem. One way is to provide a specification for what a solution looks like to that problem, which would be like a requirements document. And it's like, well, this is the problem we're facing. We need you to build a thing that does this, 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 this to solve the problem. The reality is there might be a kind of a completely off the wall solution to that problem that's way less expensive, that's more efficient, that has capabilities built in that maybe people inside the government aren't even aware of because they haven't been exposed to it. But it would be faster to deploy, much cheaper than if you built something to the specification that was being provided in a requirements document. So that's what we're saying is, like, we want to build products that we believe solve core problems in coordination with our customer. So we want to go with them, validate that they have the need, validate that this would solve the problem. And we believe that's a great way to save taxpayer money and to provide capability to the warfighter in faster timelines.
Then second to last is just the idea of software eating the battlefield. Obviously, drawing on that software is eating the world example. You actually mentioned electronic warfare in, like, Syria. I'm not as much aware of that example. So, like, I think that's a good way of introducing that idea.
Yeah. The Russians had a kind of test zone in Syria where they were proving out some of their electronic warfare capabilities. That have been, I'm assuming those lessons have been super useful for the way that they're trying to control airspace in particular in Ukraine. So electronic warfare is using things like signal jammers, GPS denial, cyber warfare in some cases, to make it impossible for your adversary to operate in the way that they have planned to operate. These are... in a large part, their software capabilities. It's the ability to say, we're leveraging off the shelf hardware. We're leveraging, non exquisite hardware. And the advantage that we're generating off of that is lines of code. The large defense companies in the United States for decades have been what I would say hardware defined and software enabled. So they have, these big exquisite systems, they have code on them. Sometimes they're even measuring the productivity of the code by how many lines it is, which for anyone that works in software engineering, how ridiculous that is as a metric. But we're trying to flip that on its head at Anduril. We're trying to say, what if we built a software defined capability that's just enabled by hardware? And I think if you did that, you would not only be able to reduce the cost massively of these capabilities, but you would also be able to move much more quickly because you can push updates to software much more quickly than you can do that with hardware. And it would also, as a result, lead to us being able to stay ahead of our adversary as they're going through some of those same iteration loops.
And the last one we could do really quickly because you kind of addressed it already, just controlling defense budgets. And I guess the way I'll re-ask the question then to illustrate the principle is, what is your frame for thinking through the defense budget? It's not, to your point, more with more, less with less. Like, what would you say is the Trey Stevens defense budget, theoretical framework?
Yeah. Well, the budget is huge and it continues to get larger. I think there was this expectation in the Biden administration that there would be a flattening or a reduction in the budget. We have not seen that. The budget continues to go up, even beyond the Trump era levels. But we are still spending, north of 35% on cost plus contracts for these large, exquisite systems that are taking decades to develop. If you're pushing that more with more agenda, it's kind of working right now. We're kind of getting a lot of money. But as former Lockheed CEO Norm Augustine said, In the year 2054, the entire defense budget will purchase just one aircraft. he was joking, but maybe not by much.
There's a directionally true part to that.
Yeah, there's a directionally true part. So I think, you know, if we're actually going to leverage technology, we're going to do more with less. We don't need a, you know, $850 billion defense budget. We could probably have significantly less than that and have even better capabilities, but it would force a fundamental change to the way that we do business. And I don't want to suggest that, like, you know, hey, members of Congress listening to this podcast, please cut the defense budget. I don't think that's the solution because we haven't made that culture shift yet. But I do think it's possible if we lean heavily into that culture shift in the coming years.
Okay, so the last few questions. So just quickly, I don't support cutting the defense budget arbitrarily, but and I forget what the period. Sequestration during like the 2010s, like that was where they put artificial caps. But do you think though introducing like scarcity could maybe serve as a forcing function for the innovations you're describing?
You would hope, like there's always this kind of optimistic cut on this that, you know, austerity forces more effective decision making. But I think what really happens is austerity forces a wagon circling around legacy programs. And so everyone just says, like, okay, well, we're going to continue doing these core, very expensive things. We're going to protect them at all costs. And then we're going to cannibalize the budget of all of the new programs. And so we're going to kill the research and engineering budget. We're going to kill DARPA. We're going to kill, you know, the DIU. We're going to kill all this stuff. And the only people that don't benefit in the long run is the warfighter. So I wish it worked that way. I don't think in practice that's actually what happens.
So here's the last question. There's a bunch of different constituencies that are listening to this episode. We have a Morgan Deason Hill staffer following. So I'd love to get you, have you offer just takeaways to like different segments of the audience. So to the Hill staffers who are listening to this episode, like what should they be thinking about? Like what should their takeaway from, like what should they be doing perspective be?
Yeah. I think some really great steps have been made. You know, the DoD is becoming a better buyer. They're, you know, talking a lot at least about the changes that need to be made. There's, you know, cultural shift that's happening at a broad level across the services. So I think things are going reasonably well. The one thing that I would continue to push, and I this is the same thing that I would say to members of the DoD senior leadership as well as Hill staffers, members of Congress, is we need winners. We desperately need winners. The only reason Anduril exists today is because Palantir and SpaceX existed before us. And the only reason you're seeing this increase in defense technology focused companies pop up today is because of Anduril and Palantir and SpaceX and venture investors believing that they can make successful investments because they've seen successful investments in this sector happen in the past. You know, last year, 2021, aerospace and defense venture capital set a record. We're going to break that record this year in 2022. And this is really good in some ways because it signals that there's more interest in the industry. The DoD doesn't have to own the cost of developing all these capabilities on their own. Private sector is going to step up to provide finance themselves. But it's also a potential risk because if the DoD doesn't step up as a customer and you don't see winners that are coming out of that ecosystem, the funding will dry up, and it might dry up for a little while because there's, you know, there's some level of memory in these venture capital investor, professional investors. So I think it's a huge opportunity. It's also a bit of a risk, but, you know, we're in a much better place today than we were 5 years ago.
Other constituency would be venture capitalists such as yourself. Obviously, this has been a difficult space to invest in the past two decades, or else we wouldn't, if it were easy, we wouldn't be having, let's do this conversation. There's been kind of a flowering though, of practices like interested in this space, that happened during a period of like low interest rates and, you know, a real bull market. What's your advice for folks who are there for the long run, but are definitely going to face a lot more skepticism, maybe from their LPs than they were, let's say during mid 2021?
I actually think they'll face less skepticism from their LPs today because there's a flight to quality. And The DoD is not a fickle market. You know, they're very sticky customers. When they've committed to moving forward with the technology product, they're going to stick with that. You know, it's a it is recession resilient. You know, the defense budgets, as I said, are not going down. So I think a lot of the interest you've seen, particularly this year from venture investors, as it's kind of been reinvigorated, is related to this. It's that a lot of these other sectors like Web3, fintech, stuff like that seem a lot more risky. These strategic kind of categories are actually less risky today than they probably felt in 2021.
So for the last question and last constituency, it'd really be, you know, prospective founders and engineers. As you pointed out, this is a difficult space because you can't just be a smart, you know, 19-year-old at Stanford and drop out and found a company. It's deeply unsexy from like a founder origin story perspective. So what would you say to folks who are still interested in this space, especially from the creating more winners perspective?
Yeah, it is really hard. It's really hard because it's not the field of dreams. You know, there are some technologies that you can build, and if you build it, the customers will come if it exists. The DoD is not the field of dreams. If you build it, they will not come. you actually have to like figure out how to architect a plan and a strategy to get them to show up and be buyers. And so to young entrepreneurs, first, I would say you should definitely work on something of real critical importance to our national interest. I think that's a really, really good way to use your time. I would encourage you to do one of two things. First, either go and work for a company that has done this, that is doing it, so you can learn for some amount of time, like how you operate in this space, how government relations works, how, you know, federal sales work, how, you know, the getting a clearance, getting access to the problem sets, how all of that works. It can be really, really useful to have some of that experience under your belt before you go and start a company. But barring that, if you choose to start a company, find people that have done it before. Don't try to hack your way through it Mark Zuckerberg style. You're going to want some, you know, some really talented people who have experienced the insights inside and out. And I wouldn't say like that means go hire a bunch of hill staffers right out of the gate. I don't think hill staffers necessarily have lived through the experience of selling to the government themselves either. But there are people who have, and you'll want to go out and partner with some of those people as you build the company to make sure that you're not kind of starting from scratch and trying to hack your way through alone. There are places you can go to learn about this as well. There's Decode is a really interesting organization that helps businesses learn how to do government sales. Highly recommend checking them out. You know, they're great lobbying firms that spend time helping companies spin up, getting the expertise that they need. You know, I've worked with a bunch of them at Anduril. Huge fan of finding the right one to partner with. So, you know, search and find a path that gives you the background that you need to be successful.
Really well said. Trey, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Great. Thanks, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.